From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Do you recognize the team playing at your local NBA arena? If you live in New York, Cleveland, Denver, or Houston, you might need a program. This week on Only a Game, we survey the NBA's landscape post-trading deadline. Also, to attract the Junior Olympics, the citizens of a small Connecticut town band together to build a new ski jump tower.
There aren't words. There aren't words. It was so beautiful. The power of community is with us, and you feel that. That's special.
And given the reissuing of the autobiography of perhaps basketball's greatest player, we'll check in with Oscar Robertson. Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. As of this week, the New York Knicks feature Carmelo Anthony and Chauncey Billups, late of the Denver Nuggets. Over a score of other NBA players changed teams as Thursday's trade deadline approached, and we'll get to some of them a little later on. But the Knicks led the league in acquiring stars, so I thought we'd see how one Knicks fan feels about those acquisitions. Jeremy Flynn grew up on Long Island, and he's currently a student at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York.
I've been a Knicks fan my whole life. Probably the best memories I have was when I was younger, pretending to be Patrick Ewing. A nice white Long Island Jew trying to be Patrick Ewing.
Jeremy's delighted that his team has acquired Carmelo Anthony and Chauncey Billups, but despite the fact that the Knicks already have yet another star in Amari Stoudemire, Jeremy is still hungry.
I'm kind of excited to see them kind of working together to bring in a third player to kind of really give us a dynasty to compete with the likes of the Celtics or even the Lakers. So
this is a New York attitude if I ever saw one, always looking for more.
Well, we got to want the best. We play on the best stage in the world, so we got to put the best show up there.
In at least one opposing camp, the inclination of the wealthiest teams to stockpile standout talent is not playing well. Greg Miller, the owner of the Utah Jazz team that traded all-star point guard Deron Williams to New Jersey this week, sounded a warning of sorts.
I'm not interested in seeing congregations of star players on a handful of teams throughout the league. I don't think it does the teams any good. It doesn't do the fans any good. It doesn't do the sponsors any good. And I would like to see as much parity as there can be in the league.
Yeah, parody, whatever. But what most fans wanted to know was if any team had gotten a lot better overnight. I asked Chris Thomason, a senior NBA writer for AOL Fanhouse, to weigh in on that.
The Knicks got Carmelo Anthony, but they kind of stripped their depth. I think the Knicks will be better for the long term with Carmelo Anthony and Amari Stoudemire teaming together. But for the short term, I think they're about the same. Kind of the same with the New Jersey Nets, who acquired Deron Williams from Utah. But to say that there was a trade that has instantly made a team better, I can't say that.
Chris Thomason is being cautious in part because several trades included future draft picks. Nobody knows who those picks will be. With regard to college players, the risk has increased in recent years because those drafting players don't get much of a look at the prospects.
Way back when it was college seniors and juniors in the draft, you had a better idea of how a draft pick might turn out. Now it's often a crapshoot because you're drafting these guys after 1 year in college, and sometimes they didn't even play all that much in college because they were so raw.
Of course, even proven players can surprise their new employers, sometimes by scoring twice as many points as they've ever scored, sometimes by threatening to retire. Oklahoma Thunder fans are hoping that center Kendrick Perkins and guard Nate Robinson will relish larger roles with their team than they had with the Boston Celtics, who traded them for center Nenad Krstić and swingman Jeff Green. Chris Thomason is not sure that trade will work out the way the Celtics hope it will.
Jeff Green is a guy who came close to making the world championship team last summer for the Oklahoma City Thunder. But Kendrick Perkins kind of gives the Celtics that intangible, or gave them that intangible. And many people think if he didn't go down with that knee injury in Game 6 of the NBA Finals last year, the Celtics would have ended up beating the Lakers for the title.
In one of the other notable NBA address changes, Baron Davis, late of the Los Angeles Clippers, was traded to the Cleveland Cavaliers. Whatever dismay this may have caused among scattered Clippers fans is nothing compared to what fans of the Denver Nuggets are experiencing in the wake of the loss of both Carmelo Anthony and Chauncey Billups.
The way the trade negotiations drug out, I think most of the people in Denver and certainly the hardcore Nuggets fans had kind of grown tired of it. They wanted the focus to be on the team making the playoffs and winning games, and not how much of a showcase could be made for Carmelo Anthony.
That's Irv Moss, a sports columnist for the Denver Post. Despite fans' weariness with the trade talk, Moss says Nuggets 30-year-old team president Josh Kroenke felt compelled to take the unusual step of apologizing for trading away the team's star players.
Instead of being the calloused so-called, you know, sports general manager who might just say this is part of the business, I think that it did affect him a little differently than, say, if he has 10 years of experience in the job and is faced with another ordeal like this.
Moss says Nuggets fans will miss Billups more than Anthony. Billups went to George Washington High School in Denver and played for the University of Colorado, and the point guard's second stint with the Nuggets made him even more popular.
He's always been a great fan favorite in Denver. He not only plays well, but he did a lot of things in the community that really raised his image.
Still, when the Nuggets drafted Carmelo Anthony in 2003, they'd gone 9 straight seasons without a winning record. With Anthony, they went to the playoffs 7 consecutive times. Nuggets management has tried to reassure fans that this is not the start of a rebuilding period. The reassurance may not be necessary. Moss says Mile High sports fans, like fans of pro teams elsewhere, are used to change.
Players come and go. Fans of professional sports get pretty used to that happening. It doesn't happen every year, but when it does, I think they kind of ride with it.
Riding with it was not the tactic 5 members of the Detroit Pistons employed. Apparently dismayed that they were not traded to some more promising aggregation, yesterday Tracy McGrady, Richard Hamilton, Tayshaun Prince, Chris Wilcox, and Ben Wallace staged what has been termed a player protest and failed to show up for practice. This spring, Florida may once again be hockey country. At least that's what fans of the recently moribund but currently resurgent Tampa Bay Lightning are hoping. From Tampa, Bobby O'Brien has our story.
It's a Saturday morning before the Tampa Bay Lightning take on Florida's other hockey team, the Panthers. Just outside the locker room, team captain Vinny LeCavalier reminisces on the Lightning's first Stanley Cup win in 2004. He was just 24.
It just seems like it was a long time ago. I mean, we're a winning team, and all of a sudden, 2 years later, we weren't in the playoffs anymore. That's what makes it kind of longer and kind of not as fun. Once you taste it, you want to taste it again, just how good it feels. I know that, Marty knows that, and there's a lot of guys in this locker room that want to lift that cup for the first time.
One of those waiting for that opportunity is 21-year-old Steven Stamkos, who is among the National Hockey League's top scorers. Stamkos reminds Dave Anderchuk, who was the team's captain when they last won the Cup, of current captain LeCavalier. Anderchuk retired in 2006. The Lightning's new general manager, Steve Yzerman, recently named Anderchuk vice president of fans.
Hopefully, Marty St. Louis and Vinny have learned a little bit from what happened in my time here. I really think that Steve Yzerman has put a accountability on that team, and he obviously knows what it takes to make up a team that's a championship team. So it's been exciting. It really has been exciting to watch.
The biggest difference for the Lightning this year is new owner Jeff Vinnick. The hedge fund manager and minority partner of the Boston Red Sox selected Yzerman as general manager. Tampa Tribune sports reporter Eric Erlandson says that has turned the Lightning into a team players want to come to. Players like Eric Brewer, former captain of the St. Louis Blues, who waived his no-trade clause to come to Tampa. Erlandson says what makes Tampa an attractive destination is no secret.
Obviously, winning helps. You got to have a winning organization. But they see a guy like Steve Yzerman in charge. They see the turnaround on and off the ice that the franchise has made. This is a destination players want to come now. And in a recent CBC poll in conjunction with the NHL Players Association, Tampa were in fifth among franchises that players want to play for now. And that's a huge dump because the last 2 years, not even close.
While it's day and night comparing the new and recent owners, Erlandson sees some similarities between former coach John Tortorella and current head coach Guy Bouchet, but he's aware of some differences too. Tortorella is old school, while Bouchet uses his master's degree in sports psychology.
He just has a way of being able to treat the players with respect, to get inside their heads a little bit, and you know, he uses the word activation a lot. He doesn't motivate players, he activates them, and that's a big buzzword around this team, and I think that's where some of the big differences between John Tortorella and Guy Boucher are.
In part, as a result of that heady coaching, Tampa seems well-positioned to compete for the Cup, at least according to one well-qualified observer.
They're pretty well in the playoffs. I mean, they'd have to really slump a lot. I mean, you know, and then when you get in the playoffs, like last year, Philadelphia just got in, and they went a run right to the finals.
That's Scotty Bowman, now retired to Florida. Bowman has coached teams to 9 Stanley Cups and won more games than any other NHL coach.
You know, they play a different system now. Their coach is very innovative, and they adhere to what he wants them to do, and they all have bought into it, and so they seem to have a lot of spirit. They work very hard.
When asked any advice he'd give Boucher, Bowman smiled and said, patience. And that's exactly what was called for after the Lightning shootout loss to the last-place Panthers Saturday night. Boucher, the sometimes fiery coach who has been known to call out his team for lack of effort, felt this time the team had played hard enough to deserve the win.
There's a lot of character in that room, and it's been quite a road up to now, and the guys have so much respect for our players because they've been fighting so hard. Yeah, well, it's been 3 years that the Lightning hasn't been in the playoffs, and it's been 6 they hasn't won a series. So obviously our expectations for ourselves are certainly to get in there and win some series, but we don't want to get ahead of ourselves. We're a team that always wants to think the day that we're in the present, and the future will take care of itself. We take care of the process.
With the new owner, new GM, new coach, and new spirit, it's perhaps only appropriate that the Lightning have a new music video, Hockey Paradise, performed by Seven Williams and the Brandt Brothers.
A new day is coming, and we're on the rise.
For Only a Game, I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Baseball players have nicknames. Catfish, the Say Hey Kid, the Sultan of SWAT. Lots of players may have been unhappy with their nicknames, but Joaquin Soria, who pitches for Kansas City, distinguished himself this week by speaking up about his dismay. The Royals closer, who saved 43 games last season, said he no longer wanted to be known as the Mexicutioner. Soria, who is from Monclova, Mexico, said he feels the nickname has a negative connotation and is particularly bad these days, given the drug gang violence in his native country. Good on Mr. Soria, say I, and from now on, as far as I'm concerned, he is Señor Sensitivo. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, businessman and author Oscar Robertson, who also played a little bit of basketball. But first, this week, Justine Siegel became the first female to pitch batting practice to major leaguers. I wonder if any of the guys to whom she was pitching stepped out and said, "Hey, you throw like a girl." Justine Siegel joins me now on the line from Arizona, so I can ask her. Justine, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
All right. So nobody did step out and say, hey, you throw like a girl, right?
No, but if they had done so, I would have said, thank you.
And then you would have thrown the next one right under their chin, I assume.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Tell us a little bit about your baseball career and how you wound up getting the chance to pitch batting practice to the Indians.
Well, I've been playing baseball since I was 5 years old, and I had this idea when I was 17 or 18 when I was watching the Indians take their batting practice that I could do that. I could throw BP.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a while to kind of put that thought into motion, but last year I decided I'm going to do this. So I emailed all of the general managers of all the major league teams and gave them my background and told them what my mission was, which was, you know, to really reach the female fan base. And everybody said nothing. You know, I didn't really. I got one response. It was a beautiful letter that said no.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried again, and I told them I would be at the winter meetings. And so when I went to the winter meetings, I went and talked to managers and general managers and pitched them my idea and told them what I was trying to do. And Billy Bean, you know, said it was a great idea and that he'd like to do it. And then I went back to the Indians, and they also wanted to support me.
Would it be an exaggeration to say that for you, pitching particularly to the Cleveland Indians was a dream come true?
Yes, for sure, because I'm from Cleveland. So once I had some teams that were interested, I went to the Indians and I said, you know, I really want to make history with you. This dream started with you. And that's when Chris Antonetti, the general manager, said, you know, we want to be a part of this. And the Indians committed to it.
This is great because you said, I want to make history, and if I don't do it with you, pal, I'm going to do it with somebody else. You had leverage.
Well, you know, I was persistent.
You know, it can be argued that Cleveland is one of the 10 most difficult franchises to root for in all of pro sports. Have you ever been tempted to switch allegiances?
Never. No, you can't. It's in my blood.
All right. On Wednesday, you also got to pitch BP to the Oakland Athletics, Billy Bean's guys. Who hit harder, the A's or the Indians?
It's hard to say. I would say that the A's were having a little fun with it and they're trying to hit their home runs. And the Indians were more in their regular rounds. You know, I was just a part of their practice. The A's were having fun with it. Coco Chris was hilarious. You know, just making fun comments, calling me ponytails and that type of thing, and just a good time.
For our listeners who may not be as familiar with baseball as they should be, batting practice, the whole point is to let the hitters hit, right? What would happen if you tried to get them out?
If I tried to get them out, I'd be a bad BP pitcher. You know, I mean, my job is you stand about 40 feet away, 40 to 45 feet away. You know, I want to throw a four-seam fastball that comes true right over the plate, and you want them to hit it. So that's the goal. It's not about overpowering them or brushing them back. BP is for the hitter.
Well, what's your stuff regularly like when you do pitch in the heat of a game?
When I was in my 20s, I threw mid-70s, but, you know, now I'm 36, so I've been practicing being a good BP pitcher. That's been my goal.
You're the founder and the director of an organization called Baseball for All. Tell us a little bit about how that organization began and what you have accomplished with it.
Well, I started the organization 13 years ago. You know, basically, I just got tired of waiting for opportunities and just decided to create them.
Mm-hmm.
Baseball for All is about getting girls and women into the game, giving them the opportunity to participate, whether it's as players, umpires, coaches, even fans, just to appreciate more and learn more. So we run clinics for girls, we run all-star games, we have a camp for only girls with female mentor coaches, we have girls' baseball tournaments, so really we're kind of this national organization that if you want to become involved in the game, you know, we'll help you do that.
And you have taken girls' teams to tournaments that were previously all boys, right?
Yeah, so you can imagine, we went to Cooperstown Dreams Park and we have our girls' team and they're 12 years old and so imagine 13 girls amongst, you know, 1,000 boys, and they just play their heart out and do well.
What's the ultimate goal of Baseball for All, say 15, 20 years down the road?
The ultimate goal is to have girls' baseball leagues at all levels all across America so that if you wanted to sign your granddaughter up, your daughter up for baseball, she could go from age 5 all the way through college playing with girls playing baseball.
You were the first woman to become a coach with a minor league team, the Brockton Rocks in Massachusetts. You were not the first woman to coach a men's college baseball team, but you were the only one doing that for three seasons. And you're now the first woman to pitch batting practice to major leaguers. What will your next first be?
I don't really think about making history. I think about creating a future. And that future is for these 12-year-old girls, and what are they going to be allowed to do in the next 10 years?
Justine Siegel throws right, bats right, has tossed BP to the Indians and the A's, and she joined me from Arizona. Justine, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's my pleasure.
As last weekend's All-Star Game festivities demonstrated, each winter brings us ever more dramatic and glamorous dunks. There was one guy who dunked over a car. But since 1962, for versatility as a shooter, passer, and rebounder, no player has matched Oscar Robertson. When he was 23, Oscar Robertson averaged double figures in all three categories, points, rebounds, and assists, for the season. Nobody, not Michael Jordan, not Magic Johnson, not LeBron James, has done that since. But brilliance on the court is only one of the reasons Oscar Robertson is remembered by fans and should be honored by players, especially those who've directly benefited from free agency, which Robertson's lawsuit against the NBA helped to bring about. Oscar Robertson's autobiography, The Big O, My Life, My Times, My Game, has just been reissued by University of Nebraska Press. Oscar Robertson joins me now on the line. Welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you so much.
I read just a few days ago that you are part of a class action lawsuit against the NCAA. The suit maintains that the NCAA has been profiting from the use of the images of various players for decades without compensating those players. How did you come to be associated with the lawsuit?
I had been seeing my cards distributed across the USA since I got out of college in 1960. Mm-hmm. And I heard about this class action suit, and so I followed up on it, and finally I got involved in it. Mm-hmm. I don't believe the NCAA has the right to use your likeness whenever they want to or own whatever they want to without your permission.
Your book was originally published back in 2003, at which point you wrote, and I'm quoting now, "It's important that there be some record of how the game of basketball got here." Were you and are you concerned that today's fans are ignorant about the achievements of players from your era and earlier?
To a certain degree. It's just that with television and the way things are today with instant gratification, that no one's going to talk very much about basketball in the 1960s. Or before that at all, because to really understand the origin of basketball and how it really got started. Now, no one today will look to talk about that whatsoever.
Frequently, retired players in various sports will say that today's athletes are bigger, they're stronger, they're better conditioned, and maybe generally superior to those who came before them. Do you think that's true of today's NBA players?
Everyone's going to say that. There's been a period in which they see sports being played. That doesn't bother me at all. I mean, athletes were bigger and stronger years ago as they are today. You didn't have any football players 6'5", 350 pounds years ago because there just were not any who could play.
You didn't have too many guys with shoulders like Dwight Howard's in the NBA either, did you?
Well, maybe so, but you didn't have them on TV every night. You had one game a week on Sunday afternoon, that's all you saw. Mm-hmm. Now you see guys doing commercials, you see them doing all kinds of things, and underwear and socks and headbands and whatnot. Of course, over the years, I think they probably do a lot more weights and accentuate their muscles.
Well, that's a good point. If you're going to appear in your underwear, better to have big muscles.
Well, instead of having a big stomach.
When you were at the University of Cincinnati, you were offered the opportunity to leave school and play for the Harlem Globetrotters. NBA salaries, of course, in those days were not what they are now. Were you tempted by that offer to play for the Globetrotters?
No, I was not, because the salaries for the Globetrotters were not that much to begin with either. I was in school. My grades were great. I made the dean's list, and I was doing very well on the court. I went to school to get an education.
Your debut with the Cincinnati Royals back in 1960 drew, I understand, the biggest crowd that team had ever attracted. Tell me about the pressure on you at that point.
The pressure was what what I live for and to play in basketball. Pressure is what an athlete wants because you rise to the occasion. People make too much about pressure today, but pressures are all over, all around us. It's in the business world, it's in the religious world. So pressure was no problem.
But I can't quite accept that. I mean, the biggest crowd that team had ever drawn, and they were there to see you.
But I played in big crowds in high school throughout my 3 years playing varsity basketball. The crowd didn't matter to me at all. I knew how to play basketball, and I've gotten way beyond being nervous in a game, so it was no problem whatsoever.
How soon after you began playing in the NBA did it become apparent to you that you would be a star in that context? Or did you know it before you ever bounced a ball on an NBA court?
I didn't think of being a star. I didn't think along those terms at all, but I knew that I could play basketball. That was what was important to me. I knew I had to continue to improve my game in order to be where I wanted to be, try to help our team win. But saying that I was going to be a star, no, I never had those thoughts whatsoever.
In 1996, you were named one of the 50 greatest players in NBA history. What do you make of debates about who's the greatest player of all time?
Today, everything is who's the best. Who's the best announcer? Who's the best writer? Who's the best? I would say this. I think there are a group of basketball players who are very good. I don't think there is any one basketball player versus anyone else who's the greatest. If you're the greatest, then you get all the rebounds, you block all the shots, you make all the right passes, and you make all your shots. So no one has ever done that.
In the Big O, you write that you're awfully happy that you did play on a championship team, that you had that opportunity. Would your career have been regarded differently if the Milwaukee Bucks hadn't won everything 40 years ago?
Of course it would have, because that was a way of criticizing great athletes in those days, because the Celtics had a very good basketball team, and we didn't have the team to beat the Celtics. So when I went to Milwaukee, we won a championship. Of course, it stopped a lot of criticism of Oscar Robertson.
You were active in achieving all sorts of benefits for pro basketball players, free agency, of course, but you were also active in getting the pension plan installed. Do you feel that today's players take for granted what you and your contemporaries had to fight to achieve?
I've always felt that in order to play basketball, ice hockey, baseball, or football, you should know the history of the game. You should have to read the history of the game and understand how it got started and how things came about. But that's not true anymore. People now, you know, even when you join a corporation, a multi-million-dollar corporation, a billion-dollar corporation, no one really wants to know who started this, who are the people who are prominent, et cetera, any of those things at all.
You write that you feel that you were blackballed from coaching and from opportunities to work as a basketball broadcaster as well. How and when did that become apparent to you?
I don't think a lot of players have that opportunity who were African-American. But since I was involved with the Oscar Robertson suit, which gave players the right to become free agents and the right to go to other teams, I felt that there was a certain air among some of the owners during those days that they didn't want Oscar Robertson to be involved with basketball at all.
This was their way of paying you back for standing up against them.
No doubt about it.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing these days.
Well, I'm in Cincinnati. I have two companies. I have a specialty chemical company, and I have a document management company here as well.
How are things going?
Well, you know, this is America. You know, we're having some difficult financial times. We're not making $2 or $3 billion a year, but I don't think a lot of people are doing that.
Oscar Robertson, Hall of Famer, has also been designated one of the 50 greatest players in NBA history. He's the author of The Big O, My Life, My Times, My Game, which was recently reissued in paper by University of Nebraska Press. Mr. Robertson, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling.
You're listening to Only a Game. On last week's program, Only a Game producer Karen Givens speculated on the future endeavors of Watson, the computer that competed so successfully at Jeopardy. The conclusion to her musings featured Watson on a ski slope. It did not go well.
Oh no. Dear Lord, help.
I just wanted to tell you thanks very much for the commentary on Watson. Like Ken Jennings, I wanted to very much unplug that useless bastard, so thanks especially for that crash at the end.
That message on our listener line may or may not have been representative. There were no robocalls on the line, so Watson and his ilk are apparently taking the high road on this issue. Peter Davies was among the listeners responding to the story that Only a Game producer Doug Trabu provided of Kendra Stern, the Division III swimmer whose times challenged those of D1 athletes. It was refreshing to hear about Ms. Stern's success, he wrote. Let's have more on intelligent athletes in sports that don't bring in big bucks. Josh Humphrey, who hears the program on WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, wrote in response to our story about the monitoring of athletes at the University of Kansas. Why is it necessary for schools to spend student funds to hire senior citizens to make sure the most privileged students on campus are going to class, he asked. Why not tell them if you skip class, your scholarship gets yanked and given to someone who has the drive and determination to succeed in the classroom? Diane Sidwell had a different response to that story. With regard to athlete monitoring, she left this message on our Facebook page. It would be the ideal retirement job for me. Now if I can only get Michigan to adopt the same policy and persuade my husband to move to Ann Arbor. I spoke last week with soccer writer Grant Wall, who announced his intention to unseat Sepp Blatter as president of FIFA. That conversation provoked a response from Bart Rankin. He hears the program and works for WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, and he wrote, "Good show today, especially the FIFA story. Blatter, B-L-A-D-D-E-R, has been an embarrassment for a long time." Moments later, Mr. Rankin left another message. "Sorry, Blatter," it read. "I blame spell check." And finally, Dave Pearson contributed a final Super Bowl haiku to the Mountain of Same. It reads, "It's only a game. Each year the super madness is only a game." You can reach us via the website onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Or you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life, summer.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. This is NPR.
Mascots are meant to amuse and delight. They are often fuzzy, they come in bright colors, and they dance and chase officials about and perform amusing pratfalls. Except for the mascot featured at Vanderbilt basketball games. His name is Mr. C, short for Commodore Cornelius Vanderbilt, and he is basically a big foam head, and you mess with him at your peril. A fan at the Vanderbilt-Tennessee game Wednesday night learned that when Mr. C, who was crowd surfing at the time, quote, accidentally punched the fan in the nose, bloodying it no little and quite some. In response to rumors that the fan threw the first punch, Mr. C smiled. But then, Mr. C always smiled. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, it takes a community to raise a ski jump. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Some, if not all, of the dust has cleared following the various trades NBA teams have been making this week. Have you gotten used to Carmelo Anthony as a Knick, Baron Davis as a Cavalier, and Darren Williams as a Net?
I don't think Baron Davis has gotten used to Baron Davis as a Cavalier, nor is he likely to any time in the future. It does, however, seem with all the publicity that Carmelo Anthony's been playing for the Knicks and shortly after Willis Reed retired. The Eastern Conference, and we should mention in this, I believe the Boston Celtics took two steps backwards to go possibly one step forward in what they did in trading Kendrick Perkins to Oklahoma City and their other two big guys to the Cavaliers. The Eastern Conference has become very, very interesting now. The Knicks are a legitimate contender. The Nets are a legitimate contender. And the Celtics have, as I said, taken a step back, and the Heat are still the Heat.
The NBA sent a message to players and officials this week. From now on, games are going to be noisier. Have I got that right?
Yeah, we're going to have warning horns, which I can hardly wait, given the fact that, you know, it will interrupt the 93rd chorus of Black Sabbath's Paranoid being played on the PA system. They think people have been milking the timeouts a little bit, so they're going to lean on a horn to get players out of the timeouts.
All right, so you're telling me the guy who always sits behind me at games, that wasn't a warning horn?
No, that was just a guy, yeah.
With an air horn.
Yes.
This week, the NCAA decided that scholarship reductions and a 3-game suspension for head basketball coach Jim Calhoun next season was punishment enough for major recruiting violations at UConn. Calhoun says that he may appeal. What, he's not satisfied with getting off easy?
Jimmy, just take it and run like a thief. They threw the entire pamphlet at you guys. I mean, the violation is referred to, and I have to get the paper out because I can't believe that Calhoun, quote, failed to monitor and promote an atmosphere for compliance. This can be said, I would point out, in the entire empire of Division I football and basketball. Nobody fosters an atmosphere of compliance. If you do, you don't win, you lose, and you get fired.
The NCAA has also decided that Tennessee basketball coach Bruce Pearl and former Tennessee football coach and current USC football coach Lane Kiffin bent the rules as well. Will they get away with wrist slaps?
They're also being accused of, quote, failing to promote an atmosphere of
Hard
compliance.
To believe.
I think they may get whacked a little harder. Pearl's got a track record. Lane Kiffin has become one of the most unlikable people in two forms of football. So I think they may get hit a little harder than UConn did.
In much happier basketball news, the California Institute of Technology men's basketball team topped Occidental by a point to win a conference game for the first time in 26 years and break a losing streak of 310 conference games. So I guess the other members of the Southern California Athletic Conference better look out now.
Well, did you have any idea this was going on?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We reported on it some time ago.
Oh, excellent. Because, I mean, I remember the legendary Prairie View losing streak. The story, though, that I'm reading says that this losing streak is, quote, believed to have stretched to 310 games. Are they not sure?
The building burned down. They lost some
records. Did they just decide to forget about it? Good for them. And, of course, Occidental, by the way, one of the previous alma maters of the current president of the United States. So I'm sure that lights have dimmed throughout the White House over this.
It's trade time in the NHL as well. The Penguins made 2 trades in 4 days this week as they tried to shore up a roster that's missing 12 regulars. So do they pick up, I don't know, 8 more guys before Monday's deadline?
I don't know, but I like the fact that they picked up Alexei Kovalev. I think given what they had to work with, that was a terrific move.
The St. Louis Cardinals might lose Albert Pujols forever, and now we definitely know they're going to lose pitcher Adam Wainwright for the season to Tommy John surgery. Is the Cardinals season over before it begins?
Well, I hope not, but this is a team that was really counting on Wainwright to be the staple of its pitching staff. This is really not a good thing for them.
Federal prosecutors made it clear this week that they intend to show that Barry Bonds used steroids and lied about it, and also that he's a nasty guy. Which statute prohibits that latter behavior?
Well, they're trying to get a judge to admit all sorts of character evidence against him. I hope they don't get away with it. It's just a runaway prosecutor's attempt to poison the jury pool. If you can't get him on perjury and you attempt to convict him of perjury because he was a bad guy to the hired help and to his mistress and to his wife, if this is all the great drug hunt has come down to, it's embarrassing to all concerned.
In a new book, John Furlong, who led Vancouver's winning bid for the 2010 Winter Olympics, writes about a deal that he made with the mayor of Moscow during that process. Do you think he's beginning to regret including that particular chapter in his book?
Well, the IOC, who recognizes bid rigging when it hits it flat in the face, doesn't necessarily do anything about it, but will recognize it when it hits it in the face, wants to know about this deal. The line in the book that I love is that he was dealing with this gentleman, Yuri Luchkov, the mayor of Moscow. Luchkov wanted Vancouver's help with planning its bid, so they arranged a bidding workshop in exchange for Russia's votes on the IOC. And Furlong says, there was nothing illegal or unethical about it. When we shook hands, I never doubted for a second that Luchkov would be good for his words. Of course we rigged the process, but we were true to each other, by God! This is a thief whose word you can count on! I'm reassured.
And finally, Charlie, this week, former PGA golfer and current golf commentator Johnny Miller compared Tiger Woods to the Grand Canyon. Now, this either means that Tiger's career is going worse than anybody had thought, or that Johnny Miller has been dropping acid. Which is it?
This is what Johnny Miller said. You know, he's saying that Tiger Woods is close to returning to the form that made him the greatest golfer in the world. He says, in golf, close is like the north and south rim of the Grand Canyon. I've been there. You do one little tweak, and you're on the other rim of the big gulf. When you go off one rim, you've got to crawl up the other side. Not that many guys have done it. I have no idea what he's talking about. If you go off one rim, you fall and die.
Grand Canyon.
If he's saying that even the small difference between what Tiger Woods is now and what he was prior to his life all going to the circus, that even that tiny difference tiny difference that Johnny Miller perceives is a gulf like the Grand Canyon, then it sort of makes sense. But I just confused myself, so I think Johnny Miller should find another metaphor.
Charlie Pierce, trying as he may to make sense of Johnny Miller, is the author of Idiot America and various other books, and of course he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie. That's best.
In reverie they frame it there. Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand Canyon.
Grand
Canyon. Today, the 2011 Ski Jumping and Nordic Combined Junior Olympics conclude in Salisbury, Connecticut. For the past 3 days, skiers and jumpers from all over the United States have competed on Salisbury's Satree Hill. Some of the young athletes have been training for as long as a decade, but the town of Salisbury has been preparing for this event for more than 85 years. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Watching ski jumping on TV is a thing of wonder, but nothing compares to the sights and sounds found a few steps below the takeoff ramp as athletes fly, literally fly, just above your head.
That was a little better.
Larry Stone has been watching jumpers fly for his entire life. He was inducted into the U.S. Ski Jumping Hall of Fame last year for his tenure as a national team coach and his contributions to the sport of women's jumping. He's retired now, but when he was only 8, Stoney, as the locals call him, got his ski jumping start right here in Salisbury, a town of less than 4,000 in the far northwest corner of Connecticut.
When I grew up in the 50s here, there were probably 8, maybe 9 jumps in town, and we all even had them in our backyards. We'd make them on little hillsides, and it was, you know, you just grew up here doing it like kids play baseball anywhere else.
Stone and his neighbors competed against kids from places like Norfolk, Bear Mountain, White Plains, and Rosendale, New York. Back in the 50s, Stone says, ski jumping was a normal part of small-town culture in New England. But somewhere along the way, that culture was lost.
All those towns that I was talking about, they don't have jumps anymore. Very few of them do. There used to be dozens of them, and now there's just a handful.
Recently, the residents of Salisbury were faced with a choice: invest more than $700,000 into building a new ski jump tower, or risk becoming one of the dozens of New England towns for which ski jumping is a thing of the past.
My name is Willie Hallahan, and I am one of the 19 directors of Salisbury Winter Sports Association.
The Salisbury Winter Sports Association, or SWASA, owns Satree Hills Ski Jump and operates jumping and skiing programs for kids in town. And you heard right, SWASA has 19 directors, all of whom eventually got behind the idea of building a new tower. If they built it, the Junior Olympics promised to come to town, bringing a national event to Salisbury for the first time since 1952. If they didn't, well, Hallahan says, nobody liked what would happen then.
We had an old wooden tower that has been in existence for decades. It was basically 26 pairs of telephone poles connected by that ramp, that in-run that the skiers come down. And it had gotten old, it had gotten rickety. We wouldn't let more than 3 jumpers up at the top at the same time because it would sway in the wind, just like the Empire State Building, but not as strong.
Ski jumping came to Salisbury in the 1920s with the arrival of a Norwegian immigrant, John Satree. Back home, Satree had been a world-class Nordic skier. In 1926, he decided to show Salisbury what the sport was all about.
One day he skied off the edge of a barn roof, and everybody was so enthralled that the next thing you know, they built a ski jump, a rudimentary one, but basically have been ski jumping ever since.
Every Christmas break, SWASA holds a clinic to teach a couple dozen local kids to jump, starting out on a 20-meter hill hidden in the woods. Hallahan understands why there aren't more. After all, despite the countless hours he's put into Salisbury's jumps, he's never been inclined to ski off one of them.
Never. and I think if you walk to the top of the hill, you may decide you wouldn't want to either. It's terrifying up there. The hill itself is 250 feet high, and the tower is another 70 feet above that. So when you're at the top of the tower, you're over 300 feet off the ground. It's a great view, but the notion of going down is just terrifying, too terrifying to contemplate for me.
Digby Brown is in charge of making sure everyone stays safe during today's Junior Olympic practice jumps. He grew up jumping in another New England town, Keene, New Hampshire. But he is another of the 19 SWASA directors who have never jumped off Satree Hill.
That doesn't make any difference. It's a people thing, you know.
Since World War II, not much has changed in the way SWASA prepares the hill for competitions. Sure, the organization now relies on snowmaking equipment during dry years, but the snow must still be set in place and grooves cut into the track by hand. Brown says when it's time to pack the tower, dozens of townsfolk pitch in to do their part. This year, the job was scheduled for one of the coldest nights of the year.
Yeah, right, that's right. It was the coldest night, I guess. It was about 6 or something. Plus the wind. It blew about 40, 50 miles an hour, they say, after. Anyway, we're up there just having fun. Come on.
The thing about warming up with an extra large cup of peppermint tea at a coffee house in Salisbury while waiting for the parade of athletes to begin is that it's easy to strike up a conversation with a person at the table next to you. And the person at the table next to me is, you guessed it, another one of the 19 directors of the Salisbury Winter Sports Association. Lisa Shebley says that when building a new tower and hosting the Junior Olympics was first proposed, everyone was worried that raising the $700,000, which later grew to $850,000, wouldn't be possible.
We all said that. But somehow, this little dream, because jumping is a dream anyway. I mean, it's boys and girls are flying in the air. That's not supposed to happen. So for there to be this fundraising monstrosity of a job, it sort of goes with ski jumping somehow, you know?
Nick Moore lives in the nearby town of Sharon and is volunteering this week in the ticket booth. Though this is Salisbury's first Junior Olympics, the town holds a regional event every year. And every year, Moore says, the jumps, as the competition is called, bring a sense of wonder.
It's almost like Brigadoon, that you don't even notice that the ski jump is in town until you put the snow on it. It's dark and brown against the hillside, and people come out of the woodwork to pack the tower, to help volunteer, to do all the little things you need to do, and it happens. It's magic.
A lone drummer leads the 53 junior Olympians through the center of downtown, past the Academy Building, currently hosting a photo exhibit celebrating Salisbury's 85 years of ski jumping, and past a large donation meter with the line hovering at just under $700,000. The parade stops at the steps of the library, said to be the oldest publicly funded free library in the country, where the young Olympians are greeted by music befitting a place where time stands still. Nina Lucy, a 16-year-old jumper from Lake Placid, carried the Olympic flame, just a tiki torch lit by a Bic lighter. She's visited Salisbury many times for the annual jumps, and she might be the only one who misses the old tower.
It's kind of sad. I mean, it's not the same old rickety tower as it used to be. That part of it is a little bit sad that it's gone, but the new tower and the new hill are simply amazing, and it's now really one of the best in the country, and everyone's lucky to be able to be jumping here.
Let the game begin!
And the cauldron.
It takes a while, but eventually the cauldron is lit. Volunteers and jumpers head off to a spaghetti dinner, and Roy Sherwood, a 78-year-old lifelong resident of Salisbury, agrees to one last interview.
I've been very fortunate to be one of the better ones that come out of this town. or the best. I have to blow my own horn once in a while.
Sherwood represented the U.S. in ski jumping at the 1956 Winter Olympics in Italy. He encourages new athletes to try ski jumping, but says today's kids are too lazy to climb Satre Hill's 300 stairs. They'd rather go downhill skiing, where they can take the lift. But with the new tower, Sherwood has found new hope for his town and for his sport.
That's a great town, and all it can do is get greater. Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad I was born in Salisbury, Connecticut.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our intern is Mark Filippino. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to see Karen Given's ski jump photo gallery, revisit any of our stories, or learn about the music in the show, please visit onlyagame.org. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. In our final word, Lisa Shebley, SWASA board member and former photographer, responds to a query about whether she has ever sailed off the Salisbury, Connecticut ski jump.
I have not. A couple of times with my camera when I slipped, I thought I might. But that's not the way to go.
With both feet on the ground, I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at mecfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.